Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. I am grateful as always. I'm here in Studio A. The Maryland General Assembly's 2026 session begins tomorrow in Annapolis with some new leadership and daunting budgetary concerns. Today on Midday, a look at what's ahead for the next 90 days with the Majority Leader in the House of Delegates, Montgomery County Democrat David Moon, and House Minority Leader Republican Jason Buckle. We'll also check in with Pamela Wood, the State House reporter for our news partner, the Baltimore Banner. But we begin with Delegate David Moon. He represents District 20 in Montgomery County, and he's also a member of the Judiciary Committee. Delegate Moon joins us on Zoom. Delegate, welcome back. Always good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So let's talk first about the new Speaker of the House, Jocelyn Peña Melnick. Adrian Jones, somewhat in a surprising move, decided to step down from that leadership position she's held for the last several years. What can you tell us about the new speaker and your relationship with her?
So Delegate Jocelyn Peña Melnick is a thoughtful, longtime member of the Assembly. She's been there for 20 years. And I think the first assurance that residents of Maryland can have is that she actually comes as chair of the Health Care Committee. And so you have a speaker coming in at a time where there's an unprecedented assault on Maryland's healthcare system. Our rural hospitals are projecting a 19% loss in permanent funding after the big bad bill passed in Congress. And so I do think all eyes are going to be squarely on affordability, with particularly healthcare as a prime concern under this new speakership. So that's probably the biggest top line I would throw at you.
And in terms of your position as the majority leader, how does it change your job? How does it change that particular aspect of your work in the House of Delegates that you're now working with a different speaker?
Well, the good news is, again, I mentioned she's been in the leadership of the House now for many years and as a committee chair and a 20-year member. And so she came in and already this week has announced an agenda focused around affordability, opportunity, and accountability for how government operates. But the prime concern here, affordability and the state of Maryland economy, I mean, I think that's a very familiar theme from the last speaker on to the current speaker. So in that regard, you will not see a major change in House Democrats' priorities this year. I think by and large, Maryland residents continue to be concerned about the rising cost of energy, housing, healthcare, and other items, from the tariffs and beyond. So that's squarely what the new speaker is going to be working on, too.
And when it comes to affordability, the state itself has some affordability problems. Yet another large budget deficit looms at the beginning of the session. Last year, it was more than $3 billion. This year, I've heard $1.4 billion. I've heard $1.2 billion. It's just a lot of money one way or the other. What's going to be your approach? What do you think the speaker's approach will be to addressing that shortfall? As we all know, statute dictates that by the end of the session, you've got to have a balanced budget. How do you see that happening this year?
Well, I do believe the speaker has indicated she does not believe we are in for a year of tax and fee increases in any significant way. So this is likely a year where you're going to see belt tightening. We just had the latest estimates from the governor indicating that our current count is 25,000 jobs lost, direct federal jobs lost in Maryland, and we're not even counting the private contractors there. Well, I come from Tacoma Park, which is a city of about 17 or 18,000 people, and to think of that many people not spending at our small businesses, it's a staggering number. And so you're right, we have a $1.4 billion, and that's almost, you can attribute hundreds and hundreds of millions from direct federal cuts that are in fact impacting us. But the unfortunate reality is the state can't just step in and backfill all of these DOGE cuts. And so, again, we are in for a season of belt tightening.
And the governor has called for a trio of bills having to do with housing. This is something that he mentioned in his executive order some while back about making housing, the barriers to building housing, and renovating housing, less stringent. It's going to cost the state some money. We're also talking about state land that could be given over for development. What's your take on the governor's priorities when it comes to affordability and the things that he's outlined so far?
Well, I think that at the moment, you're going to find that the House wants to move in lockstep with the governor on tackling affordability, particularly with respect to housing. I don't think anyone will deny that rising housing costs, both for renters, people trying to enter home ownership, it's just becoming unattainable. And a huge problem is we simply don't have enough housing. So it's right now it's a little bit of a death by a thousand paper cuts from a lot of local community decisions that lead to a collective no in many instances. And this is not a partisan issue, but this is a challenge for the state. We had coming out of COVID flat and negative population growth in some instances in some years. And, that just means it's going to put a squeeze on the existing and remaining taxpayers to carry more of the burden. We have to reverse that. So that's going to be a huge focus this year. And housing costs, of course, keeps popping up in polling concerns all over the state as a top priority for Maryland residents.
Delegate David Moon of Montgomery County is the House Majority Leader in the Maryland House of Delegates. He's my guest here on Midday. The Maryland General Assembly begins its 2026 session tomorrow in Annapolis. If you'd like to join our conversation with Majority Leader Moon, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. So, Delegate, when it comes to, the legislature being in lockstep with the governor about affordability and perhaps some other issues as well, when you talk about belt tightening, what are people talking about as areas that are, almost certainly going to be looked at and scrutinized pretty closely when it comes to making budget cuts, given the fact that it is an election year? For that reason and many other reasons, the governor and others have said that this is not the year for tax increases. As you've mentioned, the new speaker, Jocelyn Peña Melnick, has also indicated that as well. So if new taxes aren't on the table, what cuts do you think are going to be, are likely?
Well, I think they've already begun in some respects. So I would venture to guess that everything is on the table. And, the process in Maryland this year, the governor will initiate a draft budget. The Senate will take a look at it, and then the House will get it last. But if I had to predict, I do believe everything's on the table, and you'll start to see things like pauses in some areas of hiring, in other instances where we have popular programs, things like childcare scholarships. You're beginning to see waiting lists and program caps. This is an unfortunate thing. And it's coming at an unfortunate time because our businesses, many of them are still having struggles getting workers and being fully staffed. And so, again, we still have these challenges coming out of the years of COVID, getting population growth back on track, getting workers moving in. But as the minority leader knows, we have limited and declining resources available to us. Some, are challenges that we can address at the state level. And some of them, frankly, are impacts from, again, the federal government. So everything's on the table, but you're going to definitely see a hesitation to start new programs and new spending and many existing programs. Again, I think you're going to start to see caps on enrollment for various things, waiting lists and the like, until we right the economy and get into steadier economic times.
Let me ask you about redistricting. This is an area where certainly the Senate President Bill Ferguson and the governor strongly disagree with each other. Senate President opposed to any efforts to redistrict congressional districts to perhaps increase the number of Democratic lawmakers at the federal level in the Maryland delegation. What's your take on the sense of the House? The Senate President has said that the Senate simply does not support redistricting. It was not taken up in your day-long special session a few weeks back. There's a commission that the governor put together that's chaired by U.S. Senator Angela Alsobrooks, and it does look like they're going to move ahead and make some recommendations about what new districts could look like. When it comes to the House, when it comes to your caucus in the House in particular, where do folks stand?
I would say, by and large, the House for some time now has been ready and willing to take up the question of new maps in Maryland. I'll just point out, before you get into the partisanship of this at all, which really isn't actually front of my mind, it's the history of Texas having conducted a mid-decade redistricting. In other words, changing the lines for the congressional elections twice in a decade after all the other states just did it one time. Texas now did this twice. In 2003, they decided in the middle of the decade to draw new maps. They erased six Democrats from the Texas congressional delegation. And the very following year, the Republicans in the U.S. House appeared to have momentum because they gained three seats. They would have lost three seats if Texas had not drawn new maps that cycle. And is this gaming of the public image of accountability very clearly is what Texas is attempting one more time, but this time aided by many states. So with every new cycle, you know, they're talking about invasion of Greenland, they're canceling planned energy generation projects. In Maryland, there's 19% healthcare cuts coming to rural hospitals, 25,000 Maryland jobs lost. I do believe the question of redistricting is part and parcel with the other challenges Maryland and frankly the nation's values on human rights are facing at the moment. We need a check and balance in Congress.
There are, of course, many more Democrats than Republicans registered here in the state of Maryland, but there are a significant number of Republicans who are on the rolls as registered Republicans. How do you respond to folks who say, look, you know, they deserve some representation in Congress right now? They have one member of the delegation, Andy Harris, who's in the first district. It includes parts of the Eastern Shore and runs up north of that. But how do you respond to folks who say, those Marylanders are entitled to Republican representation in the House of Representatives?
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't say anyone's entitled to any particular type of representation, but I would say it's a valid concern to wonder about fairness of representation. The problem is, as I've noted, is you have one state, one very large state, that every other decade seems to wade in and try to rig the rules on the other 49 states. And so this is a national problem. I mean, I've said very clearly, one of the first things I'm going to ask congressional Democrats from Maryland to do, especially should Democrats come back into power in the House, the first bill they should pass is a ban on mid-decade redistricting. Speaker Johnson has that bill in front of him right now. It's being introduced by a Republican member of Congress from California, Kevin Kiley, and it would ban mid-decade redistricting and invalidate any maps created this cycle out of that process. I 100% do that, but to recommend that. But to come to Maryland and say we should stand down while the president is asking other state leaders to find him votes in Congress, it's preposterous. We're being bullied here. There needs to be a national standard, and Congress needs to do the right thing. In the meantime, we've got to protect our residents.
In the short term, given the fact that the House, as you mentioned, seems to be more inclined to follow through with some sort of new redistricted map, but the Senate is not. You're the majority leader, you're a vote counter, you're an experienced legislator in the Maryland General Assembly. What's your prediction? What's your speculation, your understanding of what will likely happen when it comes to redistricting here in our state?
Well, we're all expecting some sort of final decision, hopefully, one way or another, from the governor's redistricting commission in coming days. Should they decide to pursue any particular map that would come to the assembly, we could take it up as a bill. And as I've noted, the Maryland House of Delegates for some time now has been ready and willing to engage in this conversation and to do it quickly. So I do not believe that situation is going to change. Now, as to what happens if and when any effort moves over to the Senate, that's going to be up to them to decide. But I will say, it's a 90-day session. It hasn't begun yet. That's a lifetime in political timelines for things to change, minds to change. And again, every day, invasion of Greenland, all sorts of strange things happening out there. I just think it becomes more and more difficult to try and uphold in our one state here norms that are being trampled on by many other states. So we've seen minds change and presiding officers vote differently than their caucus in the past. I can't predict that that's what's going to happen, but I can certainly hope.
Let me ask you before we let you go about legislation having to do with ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. Of course, it's been very much in the news after the very tragic incident that led to the death of a woman in Minneapolis just last week. As I understand it, you plan to introduce some legislation that has to do with those ICE agents. Can you tell us what we can look forward to in that regard?
Sure. And just to give a little bit of very brief history, the House last session passed a bill to ban Maryland state, county, and local police from entering into formal agreements to do ICE deportation activities. I hope that this session that'll make it through the full General Assembly. But, Kilmer Abrego Garcia's case was winding through the Supreme Court on the final day of session. And here we are. A year later, and we start with the backdrop of shootings happening by ICE agents in multiple states. So, one of the bills I'm introducing is a bill simply to have the state gather identifying information about ICE agents involved in these violent encounters, things like license plate data, cell phone data, facial recognition data, and simply hold it for a future court to take a look at, should it ever be needed. Because one of the things that's I think most troubling to many residents of my state and beyond is the attempted dodge of accountability whatsoever by things like masks, changing tags often, and not making oneself available. I mean, the shooter in Minneapolis fled the scene right after the shooting, as did the Portland shooters. And so this is a very disturbing pattern. I hope it's not one that becomes a norm, but certainly I think it is entirely fair for Maryland to try and preserve some semblance of redress possible in court one day by taking actions.
All right, we will keep an eye on that piece of legislation along with the thousands of others that are likely to be introduced in the 2026 session of the Maryland General Assembly. Delegate David Moon of Montgomery County, he's the House Majority Leader in the House of Delegates. Delegate, thank you so much, and break a leg and Godspeed for the session coming up.
Thanks for having me.
And up next, after a quick break, we continue our preview of the Maryland General Assembly with the House Minority Leader, Delegate Jason Buckle from Allegheny County. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around.
This is 88.1 WYPR, your local NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on the show tomorrow, an update on plans to rebuild the Francis Scott Key Bridge. I'll speak with Bruce Gartner, the executive director of the Maryland Transportation Authority. With federal funding for the bridge in question and the budget for the rebuild ballooning, where do things stand? Plus, we'll talk about a new report that recommends a new way to cross the Chesapeake Bay to the Eastern Shore. As well, 54% of people who drink alcohol say that they were likely to participate in Dry January. So we'll talk about what happens physically and psychologically when you go on the wagon with two doctors who are experts in that subject. So that's coming up tomorrow here on Midday. And if you just joined us today, we're talking about the agenda for lawmakers as they head back to Annapolis tomorrow for the 2026 General Assembly session. My next guest is the House Minority Leader, Delegate Jason Buckle. a Republican who represents Allegheny County. He joins us on Zoom. Delegate Buckle, always a pleasure. Good to have you back.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Pleasure to be here.
So let's talk about the new Speaker of the House, Jocelyn Peña Melnick. It's a change in direction, perhaps, for the speakership from Adrian Jones. How do you assess what might be different?
Well, you know, I think that Speaker Peña Melnick has come in and immediately made some strategic or some structural changes to how the House operates. That's kind of inside baseball for most folks, but it may actually have an impact on policy outcomes. She's created an additional committee. She's moved an awful lot of people around within her own leadership team as committee chairs and some of the, with the exception of my friend, Minority Leader David Moon that you just had on, a lot of the other folks in their leadership team have changed roles. Speaker Peña Melnick is someone who I think genuinely and sincerely believes in increased communication and civility and all members of the General Assembly, regardless of where they're from or their political background, sort of working together to try to come up with a result. I really appreciate that. I think that's important in today's political times to have that attitude. But the truth of the matter is, we don't know where that's going to land in terms of policy results. Maryland has been drifting left for many years on many policy fronts. And I think Speaker Peña Melnick will acknowledge that she is an unabashed progressive about a lot of issues in her prior tenure as a member of the House of Delegates and chair of a health committee. So we'll have to see where that lands from a policy perspective.
How would you assess your personal relationship with her? I mean, you guys think you're going to be able to work together pretty well?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that I don't do a lot of health-related legislation. That's not sort of my typical bailiwick, although I've had some bills before her over the years. It's been a positive experience by and large. And since she has ascended to the speakership position, we have had multiple direct communications. She's been very open about that. I think we're people who respect each other, like each other. We have some significant political differences, and we have some significant differences of opinion about where Maryland needs to go. Because I personally don't believe that Maryland's doing very well on a wide variety of metrics. So I think and hope that we'll be able to deal with those things professionally, and I expect we will. And when we can find areas where we can work together as leaders of our respective political parties, we're going to do that and do so happily.
You mentioned that Speaker Peña Melnick added a committee. As I understand it, it has to do with matters of concern to rural districts like your own in Allegheny County.
That's sort of a separate thing. So I was referring
to
a new committee called sort of the Government, Labor, and Election Law Committee that she took some jurisdictions from other committees and started it. But the Rural Caucus is an initiative that she discussed with me at the very beginning of her speakership a month or so ago and asked for my input. And we certainly were happy to do that. There are many of the rural and exurban areas of the state are represented by Republicans. There are a few that are represented by Democrats. They're part of this initiative, too. The issues really aren't as much partisan as they are a difference of perspective. Policies that might work in Prince George's County or Baltimore County are not the type of policies that maybe will work in the Eastern Shore or farming communities in Western or sort of the North Central Maryland areas, Carroll County, places like that. So I think that the speaker's effort is to give people from those areas more of a voice and give them more of a sounding board on legislation. And again, it's a great idea. It's a very appreciated idea. I don't know exactly what it's going to amount to at the end of the day in terms of policy changes. But we're going to be optimistic and work together as hard as we can to achieve that goal.
What's top of mind for the Republican caucus as we enter this new session? I mean, obviously, for years you've been outnumbered by Democrats in the legislature. It doesn't mean you don't have ideas about where we should go legislatively.
Yeah, you know, it's strange when you look at our region. Pennsylvania is a very mixed state. You sort of have the control of the legislature bounces back and forth. The Virginia election a month or two ago went very much in favor of the Democrats, but over the last 15, 20 years, their legislature is very mixed. It goes back and forth. West Virginia, that's our neighbor to the west, they've become a almost lockstep Republican state. And Maryland sort of sticks out in the middle of that as a Democratic oasis. I don't love that, Tom. I'll be honest with you. I don't
I
love that when
bet.
I go through tonight. But you're absolutely right. We have a definite role to play, and we'd like to expand that role as much as possible. We're concerned, as everyone in Maryland should be concerned, about our budgetary and economic trajectory. We just passed, when I say we, I certainly didn't vote for it, but the Democratic leadership here and Governor Moore just ushered in a $1.6 billion tax and fee increase 9 months ago. It only got implemented over the summer, the fall. It isn't even fully implemented today. And we were told that this was going to take care of all of our budget problems for this year, for the foreseeable future. It did not. We have a $1.5, maybe $1.6 billion budget deficit facing us again starting today, tomorrow, as we convene for this legislative session. And so what's apparent is Maryland doesn't have a revenue problem. We have more revenue than what we've ever had by a pretty decent margin. What we have is a spending problem where we have a government that just does everything here. We have government employees everywhere. We have government programs for everything, and everybody is getting paid at a fairly decent level. I think some people obviously need raises. Some people probably don't, and probably don't need to have jobs in the sense that they're not mission critical to the state taxpayer. So the budget, and one of the big problems that affects the budget is our economy is not doing well in Maryland. We're very over-reliant on government. Federal government spending directly, federal government contractor spending, state government spending, local government spending, much more so than most other states. We do not grow our private sector. We are not top of the rank for a lot of private sector industries that are driving economic gains in Texas, in South Carolina, in Ohio, in Utah, in New Hampshire, even in blue states as Massachusetts. These places are generally doing better than us economically. And so we're always looking for policies that protect the Maryland taxpayer, that protect the Maryland job creator, and that help to attract more people to move here who want to be part of a private sector success story. We don't want people to just move here because, boy, our social services are better than Virginia's, they're better than Pennsylvania's. Move to Maryland and you get more government money. That, unfortunately, even though some of those people may be deserving of it, it doesn't work at a broad economic scale. Being the beacon for social services spending does not help your state grow and thrive and prosper.
So
So
what would, because it's
those are our big
interesting
concerns.
when you when you when you you know assert making you know Maryland attractive for more people to come move here, to have businesses start up here. You are in complete sync with Governor Moore, who has said very similar things about making the state and economic growth being a key to that. He also has noted ever since he was elected that, you know, economic growth here in the state has been stagnant for quite some time. I mean, many years prior to his even taking office. So the question is, what can the state do legislatively to make the state more attractive to folks to come either stay if they're thinking about leaving or come if they're thinking about coming?
You know, I appreciate Governor Moore making those statements. I just wish we took actions that were in accord with the statements. He, quite frankly, is probably the only major Maryland Democrat I've heard in my now heading to 12 years here who's at least acknowledged the elephant in the room that Maryland's economy is not good. We're too based on government spending. It's unsustainable, and we need to have better economic development strategies. But here's the problem, or here's where we would offer some potential solutions. You have to make the cost of living and the cost of being housed and the cost of doing business in Maryland go down. You do not do that by imposing additional taxes upon job creators, the upper middle class, even some of the wealthy. You do not do that by imposing additional fees on Marylanders to live here. From the lower middle class, working class, middle class, upper middle class, we are all paying more money to live here than what we did if we lived in an adjoining state, because our energy costs are higher, because our car registration fees are higher, because our property taxes are higher, because our property assessments seem to always go up, 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 which is just a backdoor tax raise. You blame the assessor, you don't raise the rate, but you sure get tens of millions of dollars or more money that comes out of our pockets. So I appreciate the conversation With Governor Moore of let's acknowledge that our economy isn't good. Let's acknowledge that the private sector needs a bigger role. But you can't talk that way out of one side of your mouth and out of the other side of your mouth, talk about tax raises, fee raises, talk about all
Well,
these
but
little
in fact, he's not
strategies that
talking
already
about
look
that
good.
at all for this year. He's saying this is not a year to raise taxes. We're going to have to tighten the belt. So the question is, where should the belt be tightened? Do you support, for example, rescinding the fees that we pay to register our cars, or
Sure.
rescinding some of the fees and taxes that were put in place the last time? And if so, how does that end up balancing this, 1.4,
Well,
1.5
it
billion
won't
dollar
wind up
deficit?
balancing it. Rescinding the revenue sources, the tax and fee increases will dig the hole in terms of a budget deficit. I've been here 12 years. I've never met a tax or fee increase that the Maryland Democrats don't like, ever. Even the ones they don't like, they put on the back burner and say, well, we're not going to do this right now, but we might do it next year if we need more money.
Well, that may be true, but Senator Ferguson last year put the kibosh on some things that the House of Delegates, did support when it comes to tax and fee increases. So, but the
Yeah,
question is,
I
what
guess
do
we
you
didn't have
cut?
a big enough tax and fee increase to pay the budget. We just had the biggest one ever in history. So I guess what I'm suggesting to you is, do people in Maryland think that we can have some of the highest Medicaid spending rates in America among the 50 states, and that's sustainable? Do you think we can afford the blueprint? The blueprint has a wonderful goal, and there are some parts of the blueprint in terms of education spending and policy that are worthwhile investing in career readiness training, investing in additional supports for students that have developmental disabilities or learning disabilities. There's some great things, but you can't afford it with the economy you have. If you own a house and you and your spouse or significant other are like, man, we need a bigger house. You don't just get it because you want it. You have to be able to afford it. You go look at that first house and you're like, we love this house. This is the house we want to buy. And then you see the price and you go, we can't afford it. We don't have enough money to make the down payment. We can't afford that monthly mortgage payment. We'll have to go find another house. We're going to get the best house we can afford. In Maryland, the strategy seems to be go ahead and buy the house. And when you can't make the house payments, let it go into foreclosure. It'll take a while. We'll figure something else out. Maybe we'll rob a bank. I don't know, because that's, maybe we'll find another way to get the money. There's no logical plan to the spending for the blueprint. It's just something that folks wanted. They knew they couldn't afford it, but they agreed to do it anyway. And now the bill has come due. So there's an awful lot of spending like that that's inherent in our budget. That I think that we can take a look at collectively. It doesn't have to be a negative, partisan, angry thing and say, look, we just can't afford this at this point in time. This cuts a few hundred million. This cuts a few hundred million. And I'll be interested to see what Governor Moore's budget looks like. As usual, it's top secret, hush, hush. No one knows exactly what's in it, despite the fact that almost certainly it's done because it's going to be
It's
unveiled in
due
about a
next
week.
week. Yeah.
Yeah, it's due next week. I hope that it's not like your homework when
But
you were in seventh grade.
before we let you go, let me ask you, pick up on the metaphor you just used, not having to do with education, but in fact having to do with housing. There's a
Sure.
trio of bills that the governor is very much in support of to make housing more affordable. One of the reasons that housing isn't affordable is because there's a severe shortage of housing. So he's got part of this legislative package that's going to say we're going to get rid of the barriers to building housing and renovating vacant houses. We're going to make it more possible for people to build on state land, for example. I mean, housing in particular is a focus of the governor's approach to affordability. If you agree on affordability and the importance of affordability, to take the housing package as an example, what do you think of that package, and can you support it?
Well, I'm going to take a hard look at it. The governor's had some housing bills for several years, some of which I've liked and thought actually were tailored to reach the result that we'd all like to result, some of which were not. The governor just announced this package a week or so ago. I have not seen certainly the legislation or the analysis of it. Some of it may be very viable. I'd love to find ways to work together on that. But I can tell you one of the reasons why our housing costs are so high is our regulatory environment. It's our regulatory environment. Ask people in Montgomery County why the construction of multifamily housing units, apartments, condominiums have dropped off the face of the earth Montgomery County is the largest county in the state. They have tons of housing needs of people who maybe can't afford a single family home. They need to find an apartment there. No one in their right minds would build an apartment complex in Montgomery County today. You know why? Because they passed rent control. So the people who invest in building it now are like, I can't get my return on investment because the Montgomery County Council was going to come in and say, whatever I charged you for rent 5 years ago, that's the rent forever. Doesn't matter if my utility costs went up, doesn't matter if my taxes went up, doesn't matter if inflation goes through the roof. I work for you, renter, versus the other way around. As a result, they've had almost no units constructed since they enacted that. There are ways to increase and incentivize increased housing in Maryland. Some of them, I think, Governor Moore, we can work together on, but some of them is get out of the way of the private sector. Stop making it impossible for the private sector to invest here because you have so many regulations and so many limitations that they don't feel it's wise. They'd rather go to Virginia, they'd rather go to Pennsylvania, they'd rather go anywhere
Well,
but
interestingly,
here.
I mean, I think there's perhaps more areas of agreement than one might think when it comes to those kinds of things, because I think there's
Sure.
aspects of that are included in the governor's proposal. And Delegate, we will of course stay in touch as we do every year as the
Great.
session proceeds. And I'm grateful for your time today, and good luck and Godspeed in the session this year.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it. Always here for the opportunity to have a conversation.
Delegate Jason Buckle, he represents District 8, or 1B rather, in Allegheny County and serves as the minority leader in the Maryland House of Delegates. And up next, Pamela Wood, a seasoned Annapolis watcher who covers state government for our news partner, the Baltimore Banner, will join me. But before we go to a break, each week here at Midday, as many of you know, it's our practice to read the names of people who have lost their lives to violence in Baltimore City and to list their names on the Midday webpage. We get their names from a researcher named Ellen Worthing, the Baltimore Sun, and the Baltimore Police Department, and we acknowledge those who have died to stand in witness to their untimely deaths and to remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far this year, four people have been identified as victims of homicide in our city. Police have identified three people who were killed between the 1st of January and the 10th. They are James Bushrod, age 55, Kenyon Quickly Jr., age 22, and Philip Jones. He was 48 years old. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back.
You're listening to 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you just joined us, we're taking a look at the issues facing Maryland legislators as they head back to Annapolis for the start of the 2026 session of the Maryland General Assembly tomorrow. My next guest is Pamela Wood, who covers state government for our news partner, the Baltimore Banner. She joins us on Zoom. Happy session, Pamela. Good to see you.
Good to see you too. Thanks for having me.
So lots of new faces and faces doing new things in Annapolis. The governor has a new chief of staff. Lester Davis replaces Fagan Harris, who's moved to the Able Foundation. He has a new budget director, Jake Weissman, who used to work for Bill Ferguson. We've got a new speaker of the House in Jocelyn Pena Melnick. How do you think all of these new faces and new roles will have an impact this year?
There's absolutely been some very important turnover here in the State House. I'm coming to you live from the basement of the State House. The new House of Delegates Speaker, Jocelyn Pena Melnick, is the chief among them, perhaps the most important person. The prior Speaker of the House, Adrienne Jones, decided in December to step back from her leadership role. She's still a delegate. And Speaker Peña Melnick really cleared the field of other challengers and was selected Speaker. And she comes in and brings a new energy, a new focus to the House of Delegates. She's rather progressive. She's also an expert in healthcare policy, which is important at a time when the Trump administration is making changes to Medicaid, Affordable Care Act subsidies, and the like. She's really positioned well to lead the House on those issues in particular, but also the broad portfolio that they have.
How would you assess the relationship between Jocelyn Peña Melnick and Governor Wes Moore?
Yeah, I've had the opportunity to speak with Speaker Peña Melnick, the governor, and Senate President Bill Ferguson in recent days. And the speaker says she has a good working relationship with both of those men. She has meetings every 2 weeks with President Ferguson. She expects to have regular meetings with Governor Moore going forward. They have worked together before, and now it's a new test of their relationship, as there are a lot of very difficult decisions here in the State House this year.
And one relationship that certainly got tested in the off season for the legislature is that relationship between Senate President Bill Ferguson and Governor Wes Moore. They are on different sides of a very important issue having to do with redistricting. What can you tell us about how that relationship has evolved and where it stands as the session gets set to begin?
One important thing to remember about Annapolis is just because the governor and the presiding officers are all Democrats, and just because Democrats have a commanding authority, a majority in both chambers, does not mean they all agree on the issues. We had a very public disagreement here between Governor Moore and President Ferguson on congressional redistricting. You know, we've had state after state, starting with Texas and California, doing this back and forth gerrymandering between Republicans and Democrats. There's been pressure for Maryland to redraw its districts to try and get Congressman Andy Harris out. And the governor wants it. Speaker Peña Melnick wants it. President Ferguson does not. Now, I spoke with President Ferguson yesterday, and he said, look, the governor and I agree on 95% of things, at least. And sometimes we agree on things, but maybe differences in how we get there. He said that's just a natural part of democracy. He says that they can work together despite this disagreement on other areas.
How is the fact that this is an election year going to make the legislature and the legislative session different? You've covered legislative sessions in all sorts of years, election years and non-election years, but everybody in the General Assembly, 141 members, whatever the number is, are up for re-election. The governor is up for re-election. The comptroller is up for re-election, et cetera. How's that going to impact the mood in Annapolis?
Tom, you're absolutely right that this being an election year is quite important. And the number one thing that matters to Marylanders is that there is a budget gap. There's a budget deficit. The governor and lawmakers have to find a way to do it. And they are not planning to raise taxes. That is what everybody tells me. They're not planning to raise taxes. And I think one of the big reasons why, they all have to face voters this spring and this fall. Nobody wants to go to voters right after raising taxes. That doesn't go over well. So that's a very big example of how people are looking over their shoulder or looking to the future when they're knocking on doors or what the mailers are going to say. It really colors everything that happens in Annapolis in an election year. People are very cautious and careful about what they're doing because the repercussions will be very immediate from voters.
What do you think the Democratic response is going to be to the assertion that we just heard Minority Leader Jason Buckle make, which was that we raised taxes and fees last year, although not as much as folks in the House of Delegates wanted to raise them. Senate President Ferguson, as I mentioned earlier, you know, kind of put the kibosh on several tax increase ideas that didn't make it through. But, Delegate Buckle says, look, we raised all this revenue last year, and here we are. We're back kind of almost at square one. Last year was a $3-point-something billion structural deficit. This year it's a little better, but it's still $1.4-1.5 billion. That's a lot of dough. How do you think Democrats are going to handle that, you know, rhetorically and in terms of their policy moving forward?
Yeah, that budget gap is projected to be about $1.4 billion. The entire state budget is in the neighborhood of $63 billion, so that's a meaningful number. It's sometimes hard to wrap your head around these enormous numbers, but they're not going to raise taxes or revenues this year. The only other way is to look at the other side of the column, which is spending. Whether it is flatlining spending and not increasing it, most things increase year after year, or there's going to be spending cuts. And we're waiting to see where that's going to be and who's going to be hit and who's going to be frustrated. Last year, there was a proposal to cut the Developmental Disabilities Administration that really was very concerning. Most of that got pulled back in the end after negotiations, but the budget comes out next Wednesday, and that's where we'll see the cost containment and where it's hitting Marylanders.
And are you hearing anything about the blueprint, for example, which is the sort of perennial thing that comes up when it comes to cutting the budget? Delegate Buckle, the minority leader, saying, look, you know, this is pie in the sky aspirational. We never had the money to pay for it. And now the, you know, chickens are coming home to roost here. I mean, it's something that just literally gets talked about every single year. What are you hearing Democrats in particular talking about when they talk about the blueprint for education?
Yeah, the blueprint for education is the state's ambitious and frankly very expensive plan to improve the public schools, to make them the best in the nation. And there's been a lot of consternation about it. And frankly, there's never been a long-term funding plan for this. Now, here's what's happening this year. There's enough money for the next school year in the blueprint fund to pay for all the programs. It's teacher salaries, it's training for teachers, expanding pre-kindergarten, all those things. There's enough money for the next school year. They're going to leave it how it is and wait until after the election to look at any potential changes to the blueprint. Again, nobody wants to do this in an election year. And everybody down here in Annapolis, Democratic leaders I've spoken to say the blueprint is off limits for this year.
And Jocelyn Peña-Melnick, whose you know, background is in healthcare policy, this is a top priority for her. Last year, one of the problems with the budget was Medicaid costs, which has skyrocketed. This year, that really hasn't changed much. Those costs still very significant. How do you think her particular personal involvement in that conversation is going to affect, you know, conversations about how to make healthcare more affordable and more accessible?
There really are tough decisions to make here because Speaker Peña-Melnick and other Democratic leaders really want to protect access to healthcare. They want to make sure people don't lose their healthcare. There's, work requirements and things coming to healthcare. They don't want people to lose their Medicaid, but again, those costs are going up. People have more complex medical needs, and it's getting more expensive to deliver care. So how do you provide that care while not, spending too much money? That's the difficult question that they have to answer. I'm not sure it's going to get fully solved this session, but expect the speaker to be a leading voice on that.
And we will, of course, keep very close tabs on your voice, which is a leading voice in covering Annapolis and all the goings on there. Pamela Wood covers politics and government for our news partner, the Baltimore Banner. Many thanks and have a good session, Pam.
Thank you so much, Tom.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, where things stand with the effort to rebuild the Francis Scott Key Bridge, plus a report on the best way to improve the trip across the bay on the Bay Bridge. Plus, we're going to talk about dry January, whether or not that is something that is, whether or not you may be one of those folks. About 54% of people who drink alcohol say that they're doing dry January. We'll chat about it tomorrow. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Have a great day.
This is 88.1 WYPR, your local NPR news station.